Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm an assistant director of practice groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called the Patent Eligibility Reform Act, Clearing Patent Eligibility for the U.S. Patent System. We're very pleased to welcome David Jones, Joseph Mittal, Judge Kathleen O'Malley, and Jamie Simpson as our excellent panelists for this discussion. David Jones is the executive director of the High Tech Inventors Alliance. Mr. Jones previously served as assistant general counsel for patent policy at Microsoft, where he spent more than a decade handling both domestic and international patent issues. He's held multiple positions on Capitol Hill, most recently as antitrust and IP counsel to Senator Orrin Hatch on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Joseph Mittal is the principal at Clear IP LLC. Mr. Mittal has served as both the U.S. Patent and Trademark Acting Director and Acting Solicitor. As Acting Solicitor, he defended the agency and intellectual property cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. In his role in the solicitor's office, he participated in briefing almost every major case involving PTAB trials that have become before the Federal Circuit. Judge Kathleen O'Malley was a federal judge for over 27 years. She was appointed to the District Court in 1994 at the age of 37 and was elevated to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in 2010. She's also has substantial experience in intellectual property issues, copyright, trademark, trade secret, and the intersection of IP and antitrust, with other areas of federal law, including securities fraud, tax matters, and mass torts. Jamie Simpson is the Chief Policy Officer and Counsel for the Council of Innovation Promotion, which is a bipartisan coalition dedicated to promoting strong and effective intellectual property rights that drive innovation, boost economic competitiveness, and improve lives everywhere. Ms. Simpson has almost 20 years of experience in policy and a specific focus on IP-related issues. She previously served as Chief Counsel on the House Judiciary Committee on Courts, IP, and the Internet. And special thanks to our moderator, Earl Bright, who's a founder of several companies, a patent attorney, and has served on the executive management teams of many startup companies in multiple capacities. Mr. Bright is a co-founder of and serves on the Alliance for U.S. Startups and Inventors for Jobs Advisory Committee. He is a former member of the U.S. Patent Public Advisory Committee. Previously, he was director of the Intellectual Property West Coast Operations at Guidant Corporation, where he directed a nine-member team involved in litigation and the strategic development of over 1,300 patent and trademark applications. If you would like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not of the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Bright, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We have a very important topic to discuss today, and one that is hotly debated. There is a lot of strong opinions on the topic and a lot of different approaches and thought processes to try to address the issue, and even some debate as to whether or not there's any further clarification that needs to be done for patent eligibility law. It's one of those very unique topics in the sense that it is a very broad funnel and it impacts very many different areas of the economy, very many different types of technologies, and trying to come up with a coordinated, reasonable response for all of the different segments of the economy that it impacts has proven quite difficult. It's proven difficult for the courts to grapple with. It's also proven difficult for Congress to grapple with. But we're going to do our best in this hour to try to bring some clarity to that and help explain what the current state of trying to address the topic is. So to get us kind of grounded, Jamie is going to start off giving a short overview of what is in the current bill that has been introduced in Congress to try to bring some clarity to patent eligibility. And then we'll get into a little bit of a discussion about why that bill is actually needed in some people's view, in view of the case law. So, Jamie, you want to give us the grounding?
Great. Well, thanks, and it's great to be here today with all of you. Thanks for inviting me here. So I'm going to give a little bit of background on this topic and the bill that we're going to discuss today, the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act. I know many of you probably are familiar with this topic, so I'm going to try and move quickly, but point you to areas you might want to go if you want to get a little bit more background. To avoid any spoilers, I am in the camp that we do really need this bill, and I will provide some explanation as I explain the bill and where it came from that supports that, but I think we'll get into more of that discussion later. So to get us started, I'm going to share a few slides. All right, so before I go into the slides and the operative language of the bill, I just kind of want to situate what we're talking about in the context of patent law. So we're talking about Section 101 of the Patent Act, which defines what innovations belong in the patent system and what ones do not. So it's, as I've kind of mentioned, a very foundational part of the patent law, but it's only the first step in deciding whether or not an innovation would get a patent. So it's kind of the gatekeeper statute. You decide whether or not this is something we even want to consider further or not. And then we move on to the next steps of the patentability analysis, which look at issues such as, is this innovation really new? Is it obvious? Did the inventor disclose enough to warrant patent protection? And all of these other steps that are necessary to decide whether or not you get a patent. Section 101 is just the first step, but it's a very important step. So why are we here? This part of the statute has been around since virtually the beginning of the country. The first Patent Act passed in 1790. The Second Patent Act, 1793. And this part of the statute has almost the same wording as it had back in those days. It's very broad, and there have been a number of Supreme Court cases over the centuries looking at that. But within the last 10 to 15 years, the Supreme Court decided a series of four cases that really changed the scope of what this part of the Patent Act does. So now I'm going to move to the next slide and let you know kind of where we ended up after these four cases. We ended up with what some people call as a shorthand, the two-part Alice test, from the name of the case that was the last one of these four cases. And it basically imposed upon the statute how to assess these judicial exceptions that are grafted onto the statute and decide whether or not an innovation qualifies under the first part of the Patent Act. So it asks the patent examiner or the court, if they're looking at an issued patent, to consider, is this innovation directed to one of three judicial exceptions? And that's unpatentable law of nature, natural phenomenon, or abstract idea. So, does it fall into one of those three buckets? And next, if it does, is there an inventive concept sufficient to transform the otherwise unpatentable concept into something that is patentable? So, this sounds short and simple, maybe, but I would argue that unfortunately it is not, in two major ways. One is that if you look at the word abstract idea, part of the problem is abstract idea is never defined. It wasn't defined by the Supreme Court, and it's never been defined by lower courts either. And it's kind of proven to be a moving target. And I would argue that that has injected a lot of uncertainty into the law, especially in areas of computer-implemented inventions, which are very important to our economy for obvious reasons. So it's created this gray area that's made a lot of patents inherently unstable in this area, even if they get granted. It's a subjective test, subject to a lot of second guessing, subject to what I'd argue are cases that come out different ways on very similar facts. On the other end of the spectrum, you have these other two categories of judicial exceptions, laws of nature, natural phenomenon. And those impact the life sciences. And there's, I would say, less uncertainty in how these have had an impact, but it's been equally dramatic and problematic for our innovation economy in that it's made it very hard, if not impossible in some instances, to get patents in areas of new medical diagnostics, which again are a really critical part of the economy and probably more importantly, just critical to human well-being. We want people to invest in research into diagnostics. But it's hard to get companies to devote resources if they spend a lot of money and their diagnostics can be easily copied once they're on the market. And that's the whole point of patent protection. And this test, the way it's been implemented, has really just led to the elimination of a lot of these patents that were already issued and prevented the issuance of future ones. So then we're going to turn to the Patent Eligibility Restoration Act, which I would say would solve these two problems that I've just identified. To give you a little bit of the background about the bill, it's a bipartisan, bicameral bill that has been introduced in this Congress, was also introduced the last Congress, and arose out of a number of roundtables that were hosted by Senator Tom Tillis, spanning back a number of years now. I know other people on this panel were involved in this. So there's a lot of talk that went into trying to come to some consensus on what should happen in response. And this was the result. And I'm just going to say very quickly here what the bill does, and then we'll turn also quickly to the language of the bill. So what it does, PARA, is it basically reinstates the same basic statutory categories of eligibility that have been on the books since the 1790s, this very broad statutory language that's always been there. But it changes the ALICE test that I just mentioned and eliminates that in favor of five statutory instead of judicial categories of areas where further scrutiny is warranted and where patents might not be issued if it's not the sort of innovation that the patent system is meant to encourage. Within those five areas, the bill also provides further guidance for inventions that might kind of be borderline to say when are what should you be aiming for to get into the patent system. So I would say one of the huge benefits of this bill is it provides a much more workable system for what this jurisprudence under Section 101 should be. So, turning to the language of the bill itself, like I said, I'm not going to go through every word of this, but I'm just going to walk you through the major parts of the bill. The first part of the bill is the findings. So it kind of goes through what the sponsors believe is the problem here and their explanation of how this bill will address it. And I want to point you to the parts that are kind of colorized here that I think try to say in plain language what the operative parts of the bill do, the five categories that are going to get more scrutiny, and then a little bit more of an explanation of what that means in certain cases under subparagraph E there. Okay, so then turning to the operative language of the bill, this is just starting at the beginning. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but this is kind of amending and restating the first part of the bill. And then the second part of the operative language is really where the important part takes place. So this is the statement of the five categories that replace the judicial exceptions. They draw on some of the case law, but they provide more concreteness to this idea of this abstract idea. So you can see in B that instead of the term abstract idea, which doesn't appear in here, one of the things that would get greater scrutiny is a process that is substantially economic, financial, business, social, cultural, or artistic. So that's kind of, I would say, trying to codify this kind of common sense notion that the patent system is intended to promote technological advance. So artistic advance in its pure form, for example, has the copyright system and other areas of protection. It's not meant to be protected by the patent system. But as I mentioned, this bill also tries to address borderline cases. So you might think of something that allows you to do art on a computer. Like there are a number of computer programs that would allow you to draw things on a computer or to make animations or something like that. And that's where you're kind of combining something that has maybe an artistic flavor to it, but involves a substantial amount of technology. And so that is where you look to the paragraph two here, conditions. And subparagraph A is the one that's relevant here. And it talks about a machine being practically necessary for the performance of what the invention is. So even though there might be some artistic part in this example, if it's really describing technology, it really requires a machine, then it might in fact be patent eligible. And again, this is only the first step in the patentability analysis. So, is it patent eligible? Then you would proceed to assess the rest of patentability. And so, just to look at the rest of these areas, you have the first one, mathematical formulas, which is kind of a longstanding judicial exception that would now finally be codified. The same is true for subparagraph C, a mental process or a process that occurs wholly in nature. Then the last two are directed to the other judicial exclusions that are relevant to the life sciences. So this would be restoring a clear amount of patent eligibility for things that until the last 10 to 15 years have always been patent eligible here and are in fact patent eligible in all of our peer economic countries, and restoring clear patent eligibility for diagnostics and related things like that. So now I'm going to turn to the rest of the bill just to make you aware of it. This part of it provides some guidance to the courts in how they're meant to apply this analysis. And of particular relevance, I just want to point to the end of this section where it says infringement action in general. And it says a court is welcome to decide this issue at any point in the case if it feels it's appropriate, which is something courts do now because this is considered a question of law. They can decide it on a motion to dismiss, they can decide it on a summary judgment motion. This is preserving the court's ability to do that in cases where the court feels it's appropriate. Finally, the bill ends with these rules of construction, which we can talk about more in more detail if there are questions about it or if we get to it. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jamie. And David, I want to hear from you in just a bit because you've been, involved with this discussion and debate about whether or not a statute is needed or not in view of the case law. But before that, Judge, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of perspective on, first of all, why are we even talking about judicial exceptions to a statute? How does it come about that the judiciary has come up with its own category of exceptions outside of statutory language? And where does that come from? You're on mute right now.
It really just comes from what the Supreme Court decides that it wants to do. I mean, this has been an issue from the very beginning. There's always been a tension between those people who believe that we should have encourage innovation with a strong patent system that really protects the inventors and the inventions that they come up with. And then there is a whole nother group that thinks that patents by themselves are sort of antithetical to our principles against antitrust or against complete control of the economy or of even a particular industry. So what has happened over the years is that the Supreme Court apparently is not in complete agreement with what Congress keeps deciding, because Congress thought they had addressed all this in the 52 Act. So the Supreme Court has said we need to step in and we need to just draw some lines. Certain things should not be patentable. Certain things should be more open to the world and to anyone who wants to build the economy with them. And so the Supreme Court has felt that its job, in part, is to rein in the patent system in a way that Congress itself did not believe was necessary. And so that's the tension really is between whether who's in charge. Is it Congress who's to say what the patent system is and to define it? That seems to be what the founders had in mind. Or is it the Supreme Court who can say, for reasons related to their concerns with antitrust principles, that the patent system needs to be narrower. So that's where these come from. Over the years, there have been efforts by Congress to pull back on that, but the
And
Supreme
so
Court
is the
keeps going.
is the Supreme Court finding their authority for that in the Constitution? Is that why they think that they can essentially overrule the will of Congress? And follow-on question is, do you think the language in this particular bill will be an adequate protection against them deciding a new set of exceptions outside of this bill?
I actually don't think that they're grounding their exceptions in the Constitution as clearly as I think they believe maybe they are. I think this is just a question of where do they fall on whether patents are a good thing or a bad thing. And that's a debate that's been raging since the founding fathers. I tend to think that a strong patent system is very important. But there should be limits on it, and I think Congress is the place where those limits should come from. Will the court continue to battle if Congress passes this bill? I think that perhaps Congress needs to be a little more express in making it clear that these should be the only exceptions, and that I hope there'll be enough legislative history so that the Supreme Court will at least think twice before it wades back into this dilemma.
David, you have a heavy background in, Congress, and then more recently, in one particular high-tech society, part of the economy, and focused on software and electronics and whatnot. From your standpoint, should software be patentable? Should there be some level of protection with regard to that type of development? Or is, with respect to the primary industries that you've worked in the last couple of years, it's more of a impediment than it is an enabler?
So my members tend to believe that, and I should just start off by saying my members include the largest patent owners in the world, including the very largest patent owner in the world. So they've spent, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars pursuing their own patents, and they believe very strongly in the patent system. What we don't believe adds to innovation is having patents on things like cultural processes, artistic processes, business methods. These things are problematic. And, going back to the reasons why this bill may or may not be necessary. I think, I'm a very data-driven person, right? So I tend to believe that humans are fallible, and I have opinions on it. If you know me, you know that I have an opinion on everything in the world, most of them ill-informed, right? So I try to inform myself with data whenever possible. And I think the main argument that has been made is that this is uncertain, it's unworkable, we just can't do this. It's hugely problematic. But all the data I've been able to find points in exactly the opposite direction, right? For example, the 101 rejections at the PTO are lower now in almost every art area than they were prior to ALIS. And if you look back historically at what happened with the rejections, there's a spike. There's a period of uncertainty, but very quickly it comes back down to below historic norms. Now, that's impossible. Well, there are two possibilities for that kind of spike and then returning to below norms. One is the PTO is just not applying the law at all. I hope that's not the case. That would be very troubling for the patent system as a whole. The other is that applicants are able to predict with reasonable certainty what the office will allow. And so you've got allowance rates that are at or above historic norms and rejection rates that are below historic norms. And if you don't want to believe the rejection numbers, then you can look at the internal quality control numbers that the PTO puts together. According to the PTO, they apply the rate of compliance in the application of Section 101, which is this issue, patent eligibility, is higher, not lower, than 102, 103, and 112, which are the three other main kind of statutory requirements. So according to the PTO, at least, it is easier to apply 101 than the other requirements, not harder, and there's no significant uncertainty there. And if you don't believe that, you could ask academics, right? So there are a couple of academics, I think it's Datsov and Rantanen, actually did took a look at the Federal Circuit case law to see if it was unpredictable using the three kind of most settled ways of assessing unpredictability and uncertainty in appellate decision making, and found that, contrary to what they thought they were going to find, there was no greater uncertainty with respect to Section 101 than there were, with respect to other major patent doctrines. And quite often there was much, much less. And this has been repeated over and over. You had another academic that gave claim language to practitioners and said, can you predict if this is eligible or not eligible? And they had a very high rate of being able to predict it. You've had at least, I think, three major economic studies to see if this affected the economy. Did it affect innovation? Did it affect investment in R&D? And all three, well, they're either two or three. I'm blanking on the third. So let's say two, just to be conservative. Both of those concluded that there was no negative impact here. And in fact, there have been other economic studies that said that the ALIS decision and this kind of line of cases, at least for tech. And I'm not a life science guy, so I'll for the most part, will not comment on that. But at least for tech, for both small and large software firms and tech firms, this was a boon. And then let me add, like, one last study that I just like to address, that I think maybe makes the point of why I think patents are great and necessary and drive innovation, but not in every instance and not in every art area. There was a study that was done post-ALIS of applicants that had been getting lots of business method patents. And the authors of this study wanted to see what happened once business method patents were much less available under the ALIS decision. And what they found was that they increased their investment in technical resources. They added technical staff. They increased their investment in R&D, which is exactly what we hope the patent system does. But in this instance, at least with respect to what I would consider non-technological inventions in the areas of art, culture, society, business, sociology, psychology, anthropology, there seems to be an inverse impact where people obtain patent protection in lieu of investing in R&D. And quite often, the patents that they get don't reflect any investment, right? It's merely an idea. It's, as the Supreme Court would call it, an abstract idea that didn't require any R&D investment. So the patent system, at best, serves no useful purpose, in my view, with respect to those, and at worst, actually hurts investment in what I would consider actual technology, the places where we need investment, making better computers, making better drugs, making, that type of thing. I don't I just fundamentally don't believe that we need the patent system to encourage investment in cultural innovation, for example. I just don't. Although I'm happy to debate it, and who knows, maybe I could be wrong.
Yeah. So, Joseph, you spent a lot of time at the PTO, and David mentioned the one-on-one rejections compared to other rejections and things. So there was an effort by the Patent Office to put out guidance to the examiners, following the series of court decisions and things. So from the Patent Office's perspective, is this type of proposed bill helpful? Would it be necessary? What is your view, and what would be the Patent Office's implementation and view on the helpfulness of having clarification with statute?
Well, I mean, the Patent Office will do whatever the courts and Congress tell them to do. There was about a 16-year period when business methods were patentable in the United States after the State Street decision in 1998. You could literally get a patent on an innovative business method or, any other kind of sociological invention. And the Patent Office just followed the rules and cheerfully issued, created art units for business methods and, related things and cheerfully issued those patents. And that came to a crashing halt in 2014 with the Alice decision, which to me, the most important part of Alice is the part that says you can't get patents for, quote, methods of organizing human activity. And they made clear economic practices fit within that, which basically killed patenting of business methods. The particular invention in Alice was a way of conducting a financial, securing a financial transaction by basically using escrow. You have a third party controlling the money and nothing is sent until people send their, send out their money. And it was computer implemented and the Supreme Court said, yeah, we don't care. It's, the only real innovation here is the business method. You're just using off the shelf computer technology for its standard functions. And that doesn't, that doesn't confer eligibility. HERA pretty clearly would, at the very least, reverse Alice. It has that language that says a process, you can't patent a process that is substantially economic, financial, business, social, cultural, or artistic, which is all good. That's, basically the Alice test. But then HERA has this exception in paragraph 2A that says you can patent such things if the claimed invention cannot practically be performed without the use of a machine or manufacturer. It's not, I can't tell you exactly what that language means because it's not a term of art that's used in the current case law. So there's no definitive, construction of this language. But in the hearings on PARA, advocates for the bill have made clear that this would bring back, for example, the invention in Alice. The way that invention was claimed, it envisioned money being sent around banks in real time all around the world. And you can't practically do that without using, for example, telecommunications technology or computers to store data and things like that. And, according to the advocates, that would fit within this cannot practically be performed without it. So as I read PARA, the principal effect would be to make non-technological inventions patentable again, as long as you need to use some kind of machine or manufacturer, some kind of, for example, communications technology in order to execute the invention. And, in my view, that largely makes, the limit on business methods a matter of drafting, of how you draft your claim. If you draft your claims in a way that you're sending information around the world in the same day, for example, suddenly all of those, economic, cultural, artistic, and everything else inventions become patentable. It's a pretty radical broadening of eligibility, pretty similar to where we were in State Street. And then it's just a question of, as a matter of policy, do you think, patenting should be limited to non-technological inventions? Just confining myself to just the legal issue of, is that what the current statute says? I'd argue that the text and history, for all the talk of like, oh, courts created this, et cetera, I'd argue that the text and history of the statute pretty strongly indicate that patenting was intended to be limited to technological advances, to technological inventions. The history of our Patent Act is it was obviously modeled on the statute of monopolies from 1624 in England. The founders pretty clearly consciously had that statute in mind. That was a statute that actually restricted the king's ability to grant patents. At the time, the king was granting some pretty silly patents to friends for things like, method of playing cards or things like that, for things that weren't innovative. And the statute of monopolies restricted patenting to a quote new manufacturer. You had to show you it was a new manufacturer. And for the history since then was pretty clearly it has to be some kind of technological innovation. It pretty clearly grounded the patent system in these in this kind of industrial technological environment. About I guess a century and a half later, you get the U first U.S. Or the 1793 Patent Act that uses the language machine, manufacture, composition of matter, or process. They used art at the time, changed to process. It's pretty clearly a direct descendant. I'd argue that that also kind of creates this industrial technological context, which is where patenting is intended to be confined. And the history is consistent with that. Business methods have been around for as long as the statute of monopoly. Some very important ideas came up in the 17th and 18th century. I think that's when the Dutch came up with the joint stock company, for example, so that a company doesn't die when the founder dies. Very important evolution and business organization, but no one ever patented those things. It was, I'd argue, pretty broadly understood that patenting is only for technological inventions.
Yeah, you mentioned the style of claiming. I mean, even the Supreme Court, I mean, that's their focus is claim. So their beef is when somebody writes a really broad claim that's not, tied down to technological things. So it's always about claim drafting. So the bigger question is whether or not the any one of these particular claim drafting styles is allowing certain technological areas to be patentable or not. I mean, in the life sciences area, the fact that the Supreme Court precedent right now has basically has eliminated a substantial swaths of diagnostic techniques is a big problem. I mean, they're fundamentally saying that is an area that of even technological invention that is not allowed to be patented at the highest level, irrespective of whether or not it's novel or not obvious. They're just saying that category is not patentable, and that's
Well, Eb, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you on this one. I agree that Mayo was wrongly decided, and that to me, the diagnostics are clearly an advance in technology and should be patentable. Mayo is the product of a kind of weird branch of case law that goes back to the Funk Brothers decision in the 1940s. And in Funk Brothers, for the first time, the court said, well, if the invention would be obvious once you understood the science that controls it, then it's not eligible. And that decision just doesn't make any sense. And they need to overrule Mayo at some point. I mean, virtually every technological invention becomes obvious once you understand all the scientific principles behind it. It's an ar argument without any limits to it. And I agree that, this is obviously a field of technology, diagnostics, and should be eligible under the general rule.
Hey,
The judge,
since
hang on just one second.
Dave, you
Judge
had a
is
long
a
time. Let me
yeah,
just
judge has been trying
because
to come in a second.
there's a lot that's been said that I don't agree with. I'm not going to go through all of it, but just suffice it to say, especially David, there was a lot that you were quoting and pointing to that I don't agree with, as you know. But let me just address two things. One is with respect to Mayo, I completely agree. I mean, that was just poorly decided, and I don't know what they're thinking or what they were thinking. And the Federal Circuit has struggled with it because Federal Circuit doesn't agree with it, but it has no choice. So, but then to go back to the other point, which is what the Supreme Court should have done in Alice, is just say State Street Bank was wrongly decided under the statute. Because, I mean, and I like to say that I was not there when State Street Bank was decided. I would not have agreed with it at the time. The district court had written a very clear, careful opinion about why these things should not be patentable, and referenced things like other portions of the statute. 112, 102, 103, which I think are all completely capable of dealing with this parade of horribles that everybody keeps pointing to. So I think that the Supreme Court couldn't control itself and decided and issued an opinion with respect to this whole abstract idea that was unnecessary. It could have done it on a, most court decisions are based on the issues that are before it and the facts that are before it, without trying to necessarily say we're going to decide this wide swath of items. This was very much based on the Supreme Court having listened too much to the parade of horribles about patent trolls. And in fact, it even said so in various of its opinions. So I think that I don't disagree with respect to the fact that State Street Bank should have been overturned, but I think that's where the Supreme Court should have stopped and then waited for the next case to present itself. So I don't agree with a lot of what's been said, and I just don't want to leave it out there that somehow by not saying something, I'm agreeing with the details.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So Jamie, I'm going to come to you in just a second, but I want to ask Dave a follow-up question real quick. So David, do you think that 112 could be just as effective of a tool to, you know, basically get at this abstract idea problem versus it being excluded at the 101 approach?
I think if 112 jurisprudence were fixed, it could do part of the job, but not all of the job. And let me explain what I think the core problem here. The core dispute is whether if you have some sort of conceptual or abstract innovation, for example, an innovation in, say, the fine arts, can you render that patent eligible, or should you be able to render that patent eligible by basically just adding on a computer at the end of the claim, right? If you add on the computer at the end of the claim, then it necessarily requires a computer, and it satisfies, at least according to my reading, the sort of exception test in the current version of the statute. And that really is the problem. And I think that can be solved outside of 101. I actually probably would prefer that it be solved outside of 101. And the easiest way to do it is probably the European approach, where they say only the technological features of a patent claim can be considered for purposes of establishing inventive step, which is their version of non-obviousness. Now, that would work very well. I think it's probably more consistent with the statutory scheme. And we have proposed that over and over. We have proposed like minor changes to 112, that small change to Section 103. And those have been consistently rejected in this debate, which leads me to believe that at least a portion of the advocates of these, and maybe the loudest advocates of this particular bill, actually intend to create a system where if you just add on a computer or over the internet or using a network or with a football or with a car, you know, any physical object in essence that you can name, any machine or manufacturer, so not any physical object, but any physical object that was created by man, that would render something patent eligible. And to me, that just seems like chaos. That's not the patent system in any other country. It's not the patent system that's ever existed in this country. And I think at a minimum, we would be taking a huge risk by making those changes. I'm sorry, I wandered a little there. Did I answer your question?
Yes, that works. Yes. So Jamie, so
yeah,
go ahead.
I'm going to share my screen again. Yes, I think relevant to what Dave just said, I think the drafters of this bill are trying very hard not to simply allow the quote unquote doing it on a computer to be sufficient, where the computer is not really relevant to the parts of a claim, to the extent that they clearly put this in the findings under subparagraph E, where it says, for example, do it on a computer shall not establish such eligibility when it's coupled with performing dance moves. So, I mean, I think that this is a good case of where the language of the statute, and I'm gonna go back to the operative language, is very important. So the point is that you're trying in these kind of borderline cases where something might be economic, but is done on a computer. And the question is it integrated in the computer enough? And clearly, this is going to be something that courts are going to have to look at closely because these are borderline cases. But what I think the advantage of PARA is, compared to the current jurisprudence, is there's kind of just a clear analytical framework that this bill, or if it becomes a law, would direct the courts to apply, which is asking first whether something's substantially economic, and then whether or not a computer is practically necessary. And there are going to be cases where it's not practically necessary. You could do it something just by talking to people if it's a really simple business exchange, or it seems like a computer is an insignificant extra solution activity, which is closer to a term of art. I don't know that I'm quoting it exactly. When you get into something, and I think this is what Joe was talking about, when you're talking about doing something in real time or something more complicated like that, you might still have some borderline cases, but you're kind of getting into a realm where you're talking about something that technology is allowing you to do that you couldn't do beforehand. And that's, in my view, exactly what we want the patent system to be doing. So, yeah, I see this bill as very much talking about when do you have enough technology to make something patent eligible. So, I think we've heard kind of dissent saying that you don't want the patent system to just promote artistic innovation. I don't think the bill does that. I think it says something artistic is put off to one side. If you're putting something on a computer, then the question is how much? And I think that's a really appropriate question because we've all seen how computers in all areas of our lives have done things that I think, 40 years ago people wouldn't have thought possible. And that's the result of real innovation and real work, and that's what the patent system's meant to promote. Oh, and one
And
more
while
thing, if I could, sorry, let me exit screen sharing. If I could just say, I think Dave Jones also mentioned data, and I've seen data that does two things. One, and this might not be as disputed, but a clear decline in investment in medical diagnostics following Mayo. Second thing that I think is more relevant to the tech side of the debate is you've seen a shift in where money is going to away from things like hard innovation that requires a lot of R&D that is then easily copied, and towards things like more social apps or just, it's kind of innovation in that realm that I would say is, I use a ton of apps and they're great, but I think what we want the patent system to be doing is to be supporting, the next wave of, 6G, 7G, whatever's going to come next. Really R&D intensive next generation animation tools. And that doesn't come if you don't offer certain amount of protection to it. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
So why I was going to ask you why you had that language up. So Professor Duffy was asking the question whether or not Section 25D, if it was to be enacted, would it be the first explicit statutory exclusion of large categories of subject matter?
You want me to put, I'll try and put that back up. 25D.
Is he on a different version of the bill?
He might be, but that essentially that's what he's getting at is, the unmodified human genes, the unmodified natural material, those specific mathematical formulas and process. He's asking, is this the essentially the first explicit time that those types of things have been large categories of subject matter have been excluded by statute?
And I assume his answer was yes. Or...
No, he's asking us if that is
Oh.
yes. To my knowledge, it is the first time it's been excluded.
Would say
Because then,
right. I would agree with that. Directly by statute. I mean, some of these kind of tie into earlier aspects of judicial exceptions that I think were incorporated in the most recent Supreme Court cases, but mathematical formulas standing on their own have been excluded for a long time by the judiciary, but not in statute, as far as I know.
Yeah, the
Yeah.
statute has changed relatively little other than the change from art to process in, I don't know, 200 and some odd years.
All right. Another question
Can
is.
I just respond a little bit more to John? I think that the problem with the question is that it doesn't necessarily take into account the fact that any one of those any one of the things in those categories would still be subject to 112, 102, 103, and so they wouldn't be excluded by statute as a category, but I would think that many inventions that would fall under those categories would have been ineligible for other reasons.
Yeah. And there's also an interesting question, and this may drive John, who is a very old friend of mine, crazy, the Professor Duffy, I guess I should call him in this instance. I mean, I think there's also, with respect to the courts versus statute, like who should make the determination? In my view, there's a pretty good argument that since the IP clause uses the word inventor, that the Supreme Court actually could constitutionalize this issue and say, well, an inventor is someone who comes up with an invention. Then, so as a derivative matter, we are able to define invention and do everything that they have done in interpreting 101 in instead interpreting the IP clause to place limits on the Patent Act. But John is much, I'll admit right now, John is much smarter than I am and much deeper on the history on this. So he should feel free to disagree.
Okay. All right. That does kind of bring up an interplay between, 101, 112, 102, 103. So some of the judicial decisions that's come out, the language has appeared to muddy each of those separate requirements a little bit and has started to infuse, for example, some of 103 analysis or 112 analysis into a 101 analysis. Jamie, do you feel like that the language is being proposed now or the findings that are, at the beginning of the bill are going to help delineate those and keep them from being combined and conflated, or what is the sense of the drafters when they've been trying to develop the language?
Yeah, that's a really good question and good point. And that's maybe a criticism of the current jurisprudence we haven't focused on a lot yet, which is that some of it is melding together a lot of inquiries that I think are analytically better addressed in a more rigorous fashion under different parts of the statute. So the second part of the Alice test, asking about whether or not there's an inventive concept sufficient to bring something back into the patent system, it's kind of another way of asking whether or not there's something new. And that's really an inquiry that should be happening under Section 102 and 103 in a more rigorous fashion, looking at the prior art, et cetera. And I think it's the pretty clear intention of the drafters of this bill to try and reestablish those clear analytical lines. So 101 is looking as the judge said, at categories that would now not be patent eligible. And then it's saying, and it does say this in the findings, that that you should be not conducting any of the inquiries under the other statutes under 101. And I think another way that the bill kind of underscores that this is what should be happening is it's eliminated use of the word new in Section 101. So it's another minor amendment to the way the language is currently drafted to kind of reinforce that questions of newness should happen elsewhere in the statute. So I think the idea is really to kind of just restore a certain amount of what I think of as judicial rigor to each one of these. And why that's important, I think, is because I think that will really help promote predictability, certainty, and stability. Because the way the patent system works is you're going to the patent examiner first, and they're applying what should be the same laws as a court would later apply if you tried to enforce the patent. The more that you have a clear, systematic way of how everyone should be looking at the same question, the more likely you are to come out to the same answer. And I think a big part of the problem with the current jurisprudence is something like the judicial exception of the abstract test is just too subjective. You can get different decision makers coming out in different ways, and they can feel that they have done the analysis correctly because there's just not a very rigorous analysis that's going on.
Okay. Right. It's one of the topic I wanted to cover. So the other, this is the large funnel at the top about what's patent eligible, what isn't, that it gets into the system. The other is and it's being used and in enforcement. So it's really been being used on infringement and knocking out cases. On what otherwise would be enforcement on the far on the other end. So, so I work in medical devices, and in the early to mid 90s, there was concern about an ophthalmologist who had gotten a patent on a method of, making a essentially an incision in the eyeball as part of a method. For many, many years, Europe has not allowed surgical methods to be patented. And the United States has dominated, for the most part, medical device development and technology over our history, to the extent that there are some large European companies that come up with new medical instruments and whatnot. It's primarily because they're relying on patentability in the US to drive the investment and secure their investment. But with this concern over the enforceability of an ophthalmologist being able to stop his competitor across town from being able to do the same procedure that he was doing for his patients, and that all patients would be directed to him, rather than Congress adopting the approach that they would forbid the patenting of surgical methods, instead, they passed a statute that says the enforceability of surgical methods against individual doctors and their employer is not allowed. So you can still bring a direct infringement case, and you can still stop other people from inducing infringement, a manufacturer from inducing infringement or contributory infringing by providing, tools that would infringe the method. So you still have a decent amount of patentability, of patent protection. And so why not, David, limit this issue rather than trying to knock off huge categories up front of saying they're not patent eligible? Why not just limit enforceability in certain categories of electronics or software on the back end?
So A, I think that would be a difficult line to draw. And B, I'm gonna oddly agree with Jamie here. I think analytically, doing this through 103, I mean, the point is not to knock any particular type of art advancement out of the Patent Act, in my view. In my view, it is to draw a line between science and technology and to respect the United States Constitution, which says the patent system's to promote the progress of the useful arts, right? So to me, the whole enterprise is to draw a line between technology and non-technological inventions, which is why I tend to favor, I mean, this has not really been an option, but I tend to favor doing this under 103. If only the technological features of a claimed invention were considered in making the obviousness determination, I think that solves this problem, and it solves it in a way that is both consistent with the Constitution, with the intent of the statute, and with the economic evidence that says that in non-technological fields, patent protection can actually be counterproductive.
Okay, all right. With 1 minute left, does anybody want to have the last word? No? Okay. All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. Thanks for a great discussion. Really appreciate it. Go ahead, Sarah.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Mr. Jones, Mr. Mittal, Judge O'Malley, and Ms. Simpson for speaking with us today, and for Mr. Bright for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.